Well, we have a date with the performance studio and Susan Lewis this afternoon, and Susan has a studio filled with special guests to have a very interesting discussion and performance that involves the Bay Psalm book. Susan?
Thanks so much, Jack. Yes, we are in the WRTI Performance Studio. I'm here with Emma Schnell Barnaby, a musicologist at the University of Pennsylvania, and four singers. I will let you all introduce yourselves.
Sure. I'm Mike Hoag. I'm the tenor in the group today.
I'm Diana Whitener, and I am a soprano. I'm Anais Nahara Murphy, and I'm the mezzo soprano for the day.
I'm Josh Hartman, and I'm singing baritone.
And we'll be listening to you sing selections from your program that you will be doing tomorrow night at the Rosenbach Museum and Library, a program called Singing the Bay Psalm Book. Now, these psalms, I understand, are from a book that was the first printed book in America in 1640.
Yes, and so I was approached in the fall to create kind of a program around what would be the Bay Book of Psalms printed in Massachusetts in 1640. And we really came up with this group, Kraftworks, not really out of that, but it's something that the Kraftworks is kind of known to do. Get together, it's professional musicians, get together on Friday to record a podcast, talk about what's going on in the world of music. And so something, a project such as this would be fit right into our vernacular of things that we do. And also all of us are church musicians, where we sing a lot in some of the high Anglican churches, in Philadelphia Presbyterian churches. And so it's really in our blood already. And so this group kind of gets together and workshops different projects such as this. So it's kraftworksmusic.org.
Great. So Emma, tell us about the first psalm.
So the first psalm we're going to hear today is Psalm 27, which in prose version that most of you might know in English is known as "The Lord is my light and my salvation." So it's like a declaration of faith. And the tune's called York. It's probably written in England in the 16th century. And it was harmonized by the father of John Milton, the author of Paradise Lost. So John Milton Sr. So that's kind of an interesting fact. He was actually a well-known composer and arranger in the 16th century. So let's have it.
The Lord my light and my health is, what shall make me dismay? The Lord is my life's strength and hope, should I be then afraid? When wicked men mine enemies, and my foes in battle against me come to eat my flesh, themselves stumble and fell.
All right.
That was beautiful.
Yeah, it was. One thing that you might notice if you're listening to this is that the tune is not in the soprano. It's actually in the tenor line.
That's me.
So that's Mike. Yeah. So if you're wondering why this doesn't really sound maybe like you're thinking, well, I don't really recognize that tune, you actually might recognize the tenor line of it. That's the tune.
And it's so uncommon that the tenor has the melody. It's
usually well, today it is.
So now today I had to actually sing melody, which
yeah,
is a little weird.
And so all of the psalms are set this way.
Well, it is so interesting because psalms were written thousands of years before, or hundreds and a thousand years before Christ. And this book, though, was very significant, this rare book. There are only 11 copies in the United States. The Rosenbach has one of them. Did you, by any chance, bring it?
Oh, no. Unfortunately not. I'm actually afraid to touch it.
They've asked me if I want to. I don't think it won't leave those walls for unless on special events.
It's a little old to be brought around. No.
So what was so significant about this particular book?
So this was actually a new translation of the Book of Psalms in America from the Hebrew in early America. So by Richard Mather, John Eliot, and Thomas Weld, as well as some helpers. But the Puritans wanted their own actual most literal as possible translation. So some of the texts are actually kind of awkward. The syllables don't really get accented in places where they might fit with these tunes. So it's a little, we're noticing this as we do these.
Well, you bring up a good point because the Psalms are poetry, biblical poetry, and then you also have the tunes. And I understand this book has a lot of psalms, the complete psalms, 150 psalms, and 40 common tunes. And there you can kind of mix and match them.
Yeah, so actually the book doesn't have any music, but these psalms are in different meters, but mostly they're in what we call common meter, which is 8 syllables, 6 syllables, 8 syllables, 6 syllables. So there are tunes, there are 40 common tunes in a in the Psalter that we used, that the Bass Psalm book, you know, sort of directs the reader to in order to find tunes for these, which was compiled by Thomas Ravenscroft in England in 1621. There are 40 tunes that match this meter, so you can mix and match. And so that's what we've done, actually.
And Susan, we kind of talked about it. These tunes you might recognize, but don't remember the words exactly. So you've sung them before, have done them in church and things of that nature, but you don't remember... the words don't sound right, and that's because not only the translation, but also they would have been set to different texts over the course of time.
Yeah.
Okay,
right.
So what's the next one?
The next psalm we're going to hear, which one is it? 84. So it's known by its first line in translations like, how lovely is thy dwelling place, or maybe how amiable are thy tabernacles. So there are lots of different prose translations too, as you'll note, but this is sort of an admonition to be steadfast in faith and to walk upright in order to be rewarded by God. So it's set to music a lot. And this harmonization is by Thomas Tompkins, who was a pretty well-known English composer from the late Tudor period. And the tune is called Dunfermline, or Dunfermline, I'm not really sure. And there are some familiar things in this tune to other well-known English tunes, so listen for that.
Well, now that you can mix and match tunes, you can take a psalm and sing it according to any of several tunes. Why was it used so user-friendly? Was this something that everyone had, or many, many people had in their homes?
Well, this particular Ravenscroft Psalter, we don't know. There have been copies of it that we can trace to the Massachusetts Bay Colony, but this... wouldn't have been the way that these psalms were sung in church, but like Puritans in early America, they sang a lot of psalms in their daily lives. It was a really big part of their, you know, their life outside of church as well. So this would have been kind of like the way that they might have sung it in their homes and, you know, musically kind of literate families, because not everybody could read music, but some could. And this isn't how they sang them in church, which was a little bit different. But... this, you know, this was something that people would do for fun, or, you know, you'd invite your neighbors over and sing some psalms like this.
Is so much fun.
I think it's fun.
And if this were the first book printed in America, there must have been some excitement about it as well.
Yeah.
It definitely would have been common. It would have been, there's a reason why it's the first book. It was something that everybody would have really wanted. There was a market for it.
Yeah, it was very important to the Puritans to have their own literal translation, as we've mentioned. And this was the kind of the most important, scripture was the most important thing for any kind of group after Christian sect, I guess, after the Reformation. It was very important to have for everybody to know and be aware of scripture in their own language.
And so, probably people used it to learn to read and write as well, because there weren't public schools at the time, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and reading was so important to Protestants because of the sort of, you know, personal relationship that Protestants have with scripture. If you can read it, then it's kind of, you know, that's ideal. So a good way to actually learn to to read and write and memorize these things, and kind of like become imbued with scripture from a young age, was these settings of metrical psalms, because they're so easy to memorize. Their poems, they rhyme, all that.
So introduce us to the next one, please.
All right, the next psalm is going to be Psalm 22, which is an individual lamentation, beginning with, in prose, my God, why have you forsaken me? And it's actually part of the liturgy for Maundy Thursday, or the day when Christians celebrate Jesus' Last Supper. So that's coming up next week, actually, on the liturgical calendar. And it has a similar tone to Jesus as told in the Gospel of John, asking God to deliver him from what he knows is going to happen the next day, Good Friday, the day he was crucified. So the tune is called Chichester, and most of these tunes, as you might be noticing, have the names of English cathedral towns. And they may have originated in these places, but the practice of naming tunes after English towns has been a trend since then, which is kind of fun. So this was actually harmonized by Thomas Ravencroft, who was the compiler of this set of tunes.
My God, wherefore hast thou forsaken me, and why art thou so far from helping me? From the words of my cry, O my God, I do cry by day, but me thou dost not hear, and ache by night, and unto me no quiet rest.
Now, you didn't bring the 1640 rare book, but you did bring a volume of something.
Yeah, so I have it's called a Manual of Christian Psalmody, a collection of psalms and hymns for public worship. And this book, if you're not on the Facebook Live feed, it's a book published in 1832 by Perkins and Marvin, and they had a press in Philadelphia, so this might actually have come from Philadelphia. And I was given this by my first music teacher, who knows that I love hymns and also the history of English church music, which is what I'm doing a PhD on right now. So this is a collection of metrical psalms. And instead of just one of each psalm, there are actually several. Like right now, there are 13, so four just of Psalm 13. And they're in different meters, so some of them are in long meter, which is 8 syllables per line, common meter like what we've been doing, and 7 syllables per line, and they actually have tune suggestions, so that's it's kind of fun. There's no music in this one either, but it's easy to kind of collate with a book that does have tunes in it, and you can sing them to, or any of the other tunes in these meters. So this kind of is an example of how metrical psalmody continued to be important in the United States after the Massachusetts Bay Colony time, when the Bay Psalm book is from. So it was, people wrote them. People like to have little devotional books like this. This was kind of a common thing. So this is this is the oldest thing that I own. And it's kind of a cool thing that's special to me.
So kind of when we're learning about these psalms, we're learning about a way of life.
Yeah, we are. This is a very important...
A window into the past of what was important. And they would have thought these to be important, but the materials they had were not necessarily saved like we do today. Mm-hmm. They would have known that these were important, but it was just kind of a part of culture. These were never going to go away, or at least they thought of it. And we live in a very secular society now, but these things were as much a part of the fabric of the community as anything else.
Absolutely.
And so this was just another daily part of your life, that you would be singing psalms at night in your house. I don't think that'd be having fun doing it, but this is not what people do in there at 6 p.m. after they're done with dinner. They don't do that.
Maybe not in your house.
I'm just kidding. But in my house, we definitely sing psalms after dinner. Yeah. I'm not kidding. We did do that. We did.
I'm
full of musical nerds here in the studio.
Yeah, okay. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
What's the next
one? We're going to do the next one. So the next one's Psalm 121. I will lift up mine eyes to the hills. There's a really famous musical setting by Felix Mendelssohn for three upper voices called Lift Thine Eyes, which is also a translation of this psalm from his oratorio Elijah. But this is a psalm about trusting in God. And so they'll be singing it to the tune called Windsor, which we know was written by Christopher Tye, who was a pretty famous English composer who lived about the same time as Henry VIII. So he was actually writing before the English Reformation, which is kind of interesting. But they reappropriated this as a very Reformation-friendly tune. So...
I to the hills lift up mine eyes, from whence shall come mine aid? My help doth from Jehovah come, which heaven and earth doth made.
Wonderful. Now, I was thinking while you were singing that, it's so beautiful, and we're celebrating it now. If it was so common, why are there only 11 copies today?
Question. I don't know.
Do we know what happened to it?
No. Well, think about it. We tore down an awful lot of buildings in Philadelphia because we didn't know how important they were then. I mean, even the house in which the Declaration of Independence was reconstructed. But, Thomas Jefferson would have rented that house over there on the... I think it's on Market Street. So there's a lot of this idea that we wouldn't save things like this. This was just a part of daily life. It was going to be around. Also, this is the idea of new. So anything that was new was coming out was going to replace the old. So we wouldn't have held on to these kind of things as well. But as the course of history, and especially when the United States received money, we pulled ourselves into the Industrial Revolution. And so then it was important to hold on to these things that really represented the past of what America was. So it's not uncommon for a lot of things to be destroyed in the sake of new or innovative.
Well, I understand the last one of these volumes, of the 11 that was sold, Sotheby's sold it in 2013 for $14 million. Mm-hmm. So it is now acquired.
We just would want 1%. That's all we want.
Yeah, that's right. Just want meager 1%.
Right.
Yeah. Well, okay. I think that actually speaks to the, I mean, there's kind of an archival obsession with early America things. And I mean, it's a historical phenomenon, kind of the idea of archiving. And this is something I think about a lot as a as a historian. And think the value of things changes over time in really cool ways. And it's pretty cool to be able to look at that and think about how, like, this wasn't something that was so commonplace in 1640. I mean, it was still expensive to publish books then, so maybe not as commonplace as we think, but it's how much its worth has changed just because of, you know, our own priorities and historical imaginations, I think.
Yeah.
And it connects us to our past. And it also makes us realize that a lot of the practices we have today are familiar and date. We see where they come from.
Yeah.
Yeah. To think that you were doing things today based on things that we did in 1640, it's just we don't even think of it that way. We really disassociate ourselves with the past a lot of the time. That mm-hmm. Oh well, that was before. It's not really now, but it really wasn't that long ago. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the things that the traditions we have today are really birthed out of these traditions of the past.
Yeah, and so I actually like to take our last example today. So is kind of our most familiar one. So we all sing in churches, and this is a part of history. It's an interesting, I think, being part of the tradition of this long, you know, this long tradition that kind of connects us to the past is kind of powerful. And you know, it's the religious services today are very different from anything that would have happened in early America, but I think it's pretty clear to, I'm sure, all of us that psalms are a really important part still of of religious services and that we are part of, at least in the Christian tradition. So the Anglican and Episcopalian tradition, which I think most of us are familiar with, and that's my area of study, so I don't usually speak about other ones just because I don't have any authority on them. We set psalms usually in English prose, so not meter, and they're sung either in plain chant, sort of Gregorian chant style, or in Anglican chant where we, four voice parts, sing the words together in block chords. But what these metrical psalms really do resemble in a lot of different Christian denominations today is hymns, hymn singing. And a lot of hymns are set just like this, in four-part harmony and with tunes that date from around the same period. So unusually now, as we said, the melodies in the soprano or the top voice. But I mean, it's not uncommon to walk into any Episcopal church in Center City, Philadelphia, and hear a tune just like this being sung almost just like this. So the words would probably be different. They wouldn't necessarily be psalm paraphrases, but that's kind of the nature of these common meter tunes, the mix and match. So writers since the 17th century have been writing poems and hymns in these meters and in other familiar ones. And words and tunes still sometimes have interchangeable qualities. For instance, if you look in a hymnal, you might see two or more musical settings of the same words right next to each other. So we've saved the most familiar tune for last. And it's we kind of talked about it. And I remember when Josh and I were transcribing these, he kind of said, oh, I know like some of these tunes. That's cool. This last one is the tune's called Winchester Old, which is distinguished, yes, from Winchester New. They're really creative with the names. This one's actually still in at least it's in the hymnal 1982, which is what we use in most Episcopal churches. And it's usually sung to the text, while shepherds watch their flocks by night. So some of you might recognize it, which is kind of cool. Mike, actually, would you mind like humming the first?
We all know it.
It's common. Common tune.
Is that the right key too? No. Perfect pitch like you guys.
All right. So we've also said the most familiar psalm text, I think, for last. We've set this one to Psalm 23. So it's usually known as like the Good Shepherd Psalm. The Lord is my shepherd, therefore can I lack nothing, is the first line, at least in prose. So this is going to be our last
song.
Our last one.
Lord, to me a shepherd is, want therefore shall I guide me in the fields of tender grass, doth cause me down to lie. To
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been a wonderful program, and I was thinking it dates, these words date, the music dates perhaps from one period, but the words date from 1034 BC.
Yeah.
David was writing these prayers.
Probably some of them.
Psalms of praise, some of them do, yes.
All of them.
So this has been a great celebration, especially this week when many people are observing holidays. So thank you so much. Tomorrow...
Yes.
Must be sure to mention tomorrow the performance is at the Rosenbach Museum and Library at 2008 2010 Delancey Street.
Yes, and they'll also be doing poetry by the first published author, and Bradstreet will be doing from her work. So it's going to be interspersed with poetry, and Emma's going to be talking and we'll be singing. So it's going to be a very diverse and very eclectic and rich program, 6 p.m. at the Rosenbach Museum.
Great. Thanks for giving us this little... sneak preview of it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
We had a lot of fun.
Okay, back to you, Jack. Thank you.